Morning, everyone. As Rudy said, I'm Don Sells, and this talk is called the biggest game of Clue you've ever played. And I figured that there are probably three possible reasons you're here today. One is that you never could figure out whether or not it was Mrs. White or that mustard guy, and trying to decide between the candlestick and the wrench just really drove you batty. And you're getting at the age now where, boy, you would really like to be able to beat your kids at this game. So if that's kind of why you're here, today's not going to do much for you. The second reason might be you just find this whole idea of lost person search and search management interesting. And if that's the case, by the end of the talk, you'll know a whole bunch more about search management and how it's done. And you'll have a much better appreciation for what goes on when Johnny gets lost. Finally, you're responsible for some set of systems, and you're just scared to death trying to figure out how you're going to handle the big one. If that's your reasoning, this talk's for you. What I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be talking about how to handle very large-scale problems and the management structures that you put in place for those problems. And the problem space I'm going to be using to do that is lost person search management. It's a problem space that I know. But now and then throughout the talk, I'll just relate back some of the concepts and theories and tools back to the system administrator problem space. So let me start with a kind of a brief description of a couple of incidents that give you a view for the size and flavor of the things I'm talking about. Wow. Can we? Let me see which one's first. Okay. So July 4th, this was a 52-year-old female. This was in West Virginia. She had a history of brain problems and had some strokes and some other medical problems. Her family had brought her up from where she lived in Virginia to the old homestead. She was sitting in a chair one night watching TV while the rest of the family went to bed. When they got up in the morning, she wasn't there. So that was this incident. This one, we got called in to look for, this is search for two possibly abducted teenagers. We got called in. The police had found a note written saying that these two females had been abducted, murdered, and then buried somewhere in the area. And we got called in to help search for this one. Whoa. Okay. Now I can go to sleep. Okay. So this one was a lost 55-year-old female. This one was very interesting. They had been searching for this woman for 4 days. The local police and local fire companies had been searching for her for 4 days. They called in and said, "We need help. Can you come in and help manage this search for this person?" What made it a little bit more complicated was that there had been some heavy rains in the area, and so some of the streams were flowing very quickly nearby, which made searching a little dangerous. This one was a 6-year-old autistic male. This was in north central Pennsylvania, and the problem with this one was that the temperatures at night were getting down to around 10 or 15 degrees. And as you might expect, survivability in that kind of time frame is pretty poor. We get these now and then. This one was a despondent 22-year-old male. He had been serving in Iraq, had recently come back. He had been wounded by an IED, and this was for what we call a despondent, a person who was going to go off and commit suicide. The interesting thing about this guy was that he had been wounded by this IED, supposedly couldn't walk and was blind, but we had a suicide note, and there were about 35 steps up to his house and no other way to get down. So we were a little confused about that whole thing. Lost 14-year-old female in West Virginia. This was all indications that this was a homicide search, and she'd been murdered by her father and hidden in the local area. This one, did anyone hear about this one? This one made national news just recently, about 3 weeks ago. 18-year-old autistic male lost in the Dolly Sods Wilderness area. Dolly Sods is a gorgeous hiking area in West Virginia, just on the West Virginia-Pennsylvania border. The one that made this one interesting, as I said, it made national news. So there was significant visibility in both the public and the private sector for this search. So, in an effort to keep you from flipping the bozo bit a little bit too quickly, I want to talk a little bit about what I've done in this area. So I'm president of the Pennsylvania Search and Rescue Council. This is a group that is trying to put some consistency and certification process in place in Pennsylvania, where there is no legislative mandate for lost person search and rescue. And Pennsylvania is a commonwealth which has this bizarre concept that when you're a commonwealth state, everything that's not defined by law drops down to the lowest level of local government. And so theoretically, the local police chief in Pennsylvania is responsible for lost person search and rescue in their area. For the Appalachian Search and Rescue Conference, which is an organization which provides resources across a 5-state area, I hold the certification of incident commander. This is also a cross certification with Virginia, so I'm state certified. For the Department of Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, I'm an instructor in search management, and this is the group that is responsible for all the public lands in Pennsylvania, and so they're responsible for search on all the public lands in Pennsylvania. At 4:00 this morning, my cell phone started going off because there's currently a search in western Pennsylvania for another despondent, happens to be on public land, so DCNR called. I told them I probably was not going to make it there. And then I had this little organization which teaches wilderness emergency response, both medicine and search management stuff. So that's all well and good, and you say, wonderful, why should I care? My degree is from Carnegie Mellon, where I spent both time during school and a couple years on the research staff in the computer science department. I worked on problems involving large-scale multiprocessors and basically an operating system designed for large-scale multiprocessors. We built a machine there that had 50 CPUs. It was a shared memory-based machine, and it had an interesting concept that the memory system was hierarchical in nature. Memory that was further away from you cost more to access. I worked on this project with a couple of guys that you might know or might have heard of. Who's ever written a tickle script? Has written tickle scripts? Okay, so the other person I did the software with on this project was John Osterhout, the developer of Tickle. And how many people have used a Sun system of some type? Yeah, I thought so. One of the hardware guys was Andy Bechtolsheim, one of the founders of Sun Systems. A great story about Andy. We were building a board, and it was a little tight. These were in the days when you did layout by hand, so we would lay down pieces of acetate and little pieces of black tape on it. And this board was a little tight, so I came into the lab one night, and Andy was sitting there with a file, filing off the back of some ICs so that he could get them to fit into the layout. I then went on to do some stuff in the startup world, a little company called Perk Systems, Three Rivers Computer. Has anyone ever heard of a Perk? Never used a Perk? Perk Systems hit the market before Sun Systems. They were the first commercially available engineering workstation. Had all the great aspects of a company run by a bunch of engineers, i.e. it went Chapter 11. But then I started working for this other company called Four Systems. And Four Systems developed these asynchronous transferred mode switching devices, these big switches. And I ran the engineering services organization there. And then when we were acquired, I got the opportunity to run worldwide customer services and support. And along with that opportunity came running all of facilities and all of the IT organization for the Pittsburgh branch of this group. So, September 11th, 2001, the company's response to the World Trade Center's attack. When this happened, we put in place the exact same system I'm going to be talking to you about today, an incident command system. And we used that to handle not only how we were going to deal with our internal folks. If you were all around that day, you know there was a lot of angst about what was going on. People didn't know what to do, whether they should stay, whether they should go back to work. We put in a system to handle that. As it turns out, Marconi, and previously Four Systems, one of our largest customers was the U.S. government. And in agencies that had three-letter acronyms that when people came to visit us, they just wrote U.S. government on the sign-in logs. So we had a significant amount of equipment in the Pentagon. And the question was, how do we ramp up to support whatever needed to be done? You know that service providers went down when the World Trade Centers came down. We had significant amounts of equipment there. So the issue was, how do we ramp up to support our customers in that event? I had the distinct pleasure, or more precisely, learning experience of being in charge of the IT organization when we got hacked. Interesting enough, we got hacked, and all indications were, all the forensics we did indicated that what they were after were engineering and marketing design documents for the newest product lines. And so they came in through the external website, through a bizarre set of circumstances that had to do with putting an upgrade in place that didn't work, rolling it back, dropping out something important when it got rolled back. They came in through there, dropped rootkits in, got in through the DMZ and into the company's engineering stuff. Then we put in place ongoing plans for service interruption events. We had a couple of customers who did things like, if you watched local TV stations on your satellite service provider, either Dish or DirecTV, that stuff was carried across our equipment. The head ends at the local things backhauled to the uplinks, and that was all across foreign Marconi ATM equipment. And these guys have this really bizarre view that you should never have a blank screen. That if your TV goes dark, it's not good news. And they wanted to be sure that if something happened, we had plans in place to help them get it fixed as quickly as possible. Throughout, you'll see, I hope, how the techniques I'm going to give you let us handle those things. So I'm going to talk about large-scale problems. We'll do some talk about pre-planning. I'm going to spend a reasonable amount of time talking about the incident command system and how you might think about modifying that for your needs. We'll talk about the difference between strategy and tactics when it comes to solving these problems. Talk about what you should do afterwards, and then really talk some about what you ought to be doing beforehand to make sure these don't happen. So what kind of problems am I talking about? You've seen the types of search incidents and some of the things we used in the technology world to handle these. These problems don't happen on a daily basis, or at least I hope not. If they do, you need to find another job. They have characteristics that make them a little bit harder to handle. Often they're time critical. Often they involve human life. in our world in Marconi, because we were at the core of service provider networks, things like 911 calls went across those networks. In the search space world, we do a set of calculations to determine this thing called search urgency, which tells us just kind of how time critical it is. That gets tied very closely with the life support issues. The problems may involve property loss, and that property may be either real or intellectual. And they may be criminal in nature. The solutions tend to involve a large number of people. It's more than one or two or three people trying to solve these problems. On the search I alluded to that finished last month, on the kind of last day of that search, we had about 300 people in the field, about another 75 people in support roles, and then about 25 people in the management system. Okay, so these are large-scale incidents. Those people came from a bunch of organizations, and they all have different views of how things work and who should be in command and what should be going on, and you need to put that all together to make it run smoothly. You can't be having arguments about what some term means. The resources come from all kinds of places. On the search I talked about, we had folks from a local bear hunting club who kind of knew the area like the back of their hand, but they didn't have a clue about what doing search meant. We also had help in that search from the governor. And you can bet you when the governor lands his helicopter in your operation or comes down to see your command center or control center to figure out what's going on, it raises the pucker factor a little bit. And then finally, they often involve law enforcement. And this law enforcement can be something as the local sheriff or the FBI. And as always, what you'll learn is that the guys with guns get a significant say in what's actually going on. So I want to talk a little bit about what happens beforehand, about pre-planning. If you're waiting until your pager goes off to figure out how you're going to handle something, you're way behind the eight ball. It's not the time. 3 o'clock in the morning is not when you ought to be figuring out who you can call to help you. I've always liked the quote from Eisenhower, and he said that in preparation for battle, I've always found that plans are useless, but planning is indispensable. What that basically means is that when the battle's going on, things never work out the way you expected. The problem that you're trying to solve is not the absolute one you planned for, but the act of having gone through the rigorous process of putting plans in place gives you a feeling for what might be happening and how you're going to handle that. I once attended a lecture by a guy named Captain Alfred Haynes. Does anyone know that name? So, in 1989, Captain Haynes had a little problem with his airplane. He was flying a DC-10 United Flight 232 to Philadelphia. And one of the turbine blades in one of his engines shattered. It's beginning to sound familiar. And that turbine blade went through and it took out all three of the hydraulic control systems on this guy's DC-10. When they had been doing the pre-planning for all the problems that could go wrong in the DC-10, no one ever conceived that the plane would lose all three control systems at the same time. That just never showed up in the plans. They said, we've got redundancy, not only do we have redundancy, we have triple redundancy. It can't happen. And what Captain Haynes said was that they're going through their books because that's the way you do things in an airplane cockpit, right? When you're still flying, you go through the book that says this is what thing to look at, this is the next thing to try, this is the next thing to try. And none of those things were fit. But the fact that they had done all that planning beforehand let them throw out a whole bunch of solutions or a whole bunch of possible problems that they then didn't have to deal with. So let them get down to the bottom cause much more quickly. So for you folks who don't remember the details of that, out of the 296 souls on board United Flight 232, Captain Haynes was able to save 185 of them. Anyone else in the simulators after this happened, and he did that by flying the airplane, he and three other people flew the airplane completely using the throttles. Anyone else that they put in a simulator never got 5 miles from the airport. Captain Haynes almost landed the plane on a runway. He caught a wind gust at the very last minute, which tipped a wing, something that if you had control systems, you could easily handle, and the plane tumbled. But he made it through based on the pre-planning that they had put in place. So the first type of things I want to talk about is you need to know your history. You need to know what types of events have happened in the past. Are there some common characteristic between them? Do you have the same problem again and again? And if so, how do you fix that problem each time? More than we would like, we actually see this in the lost person search world. There are places in the Appalachian Trail and places in a number of places in the U.S. where things like the trails get confusing and people wander off them the wrong way. And when you call these places, you say, we have this lost person. They say, okay, we know he's supposed to be over at point A, but we're going to go to point B because everyone who gets lost going to point A shows up coming out at point B. So that's the history. How did you fix it last time? If it doesn't exactly match, is there something in common, some way that you can kind of tweak your current view of what a result might be or what a plan might be to match your current situation? If you haven't studied the history, if you don't know about the past events in your area, you can't make this happen. So you have to study it. You have to put together some type of database, no matter what that is, that says these are the kinds of things we've had in the past, and this is how we dealt with them. You need to know the theory. There are, in the lost person search world, there are solid theories in place about how to handle lost person search. These have to be called, as grouped together, are happen to be called a set of theories called search theory, go figure. And they're driven mainly by the Coast Guard and the Air Force. They're the guys who've done a whole bunch of search on water where actually the solutions are much simpler than they are on dry land. As part of the theory, you really need to understand your problem space. In the search and rescue problem space, there's actually, contrary to popular belief, there's a lot of math behind it, a lot of solid theory and the math that backs that up. It's not about putting people shoulder to shoulder. It's not about walking them through the woods hundreds at a time. Okay? There is theory in place, it's accepted theory, it's practiced and it's used. So I'll give you a little feel for it, and this is where we talk more about the search and rescue parts of things. I'll give you a little feel for it. We have this thing called probability of area. And basically, what we do is we take the area where we're going to search and we break it up into little chunks. And we assign to those little chunks a probability of area, i.e., what do we think the probability is that the lost person or subject is in this particular piece of real estate? And I'll talk a little bit later about how we actually do that. Okay. But so for there are all these search segments, each one has a probability of area, and then there's this meta segment called rest of world. Right? And rest of world is, as you might expect, says, oh, not a clue, he's not in all these things we've thought about, he's somewhere else. Then there's this thing called probability of detection. And probability of detection is pretty straightforward. It says that if the thing that I were looking for was in this area, what's the probability that the resource that I used to find it would actually have seen it? So an easy way to think about this is, and the way we start training people initially is we say, if there were 10 milk cartons in the area and you were walking through, how many of them would you have found? And this is the way we did probability detection for years and years and years until we did some experimentation that showed that it was a completely bogus method of doing things. So if I say to somebody, I walk them through an area and I say, if there are 10 milk cartons out there, how many would you have found? Do you think their estimate is always high or low? Their estimate is inevitably high, incredibly high. If we change that question around a little bit and I ask basically the 1 minus probability of detection question, which is, if there were 10 milk cartons in that area, how many could you have missed? I also get a very high number. Well, we know that those two numbers ought to add up to be 10, and they don't. So people are incredibly poor at guessing that. This is one of the areas which is where there's a lot of research going on in lost person search now about how to come up with probability of detections. And that's a lecture for another lecture or two or three. In the end, we had this final thing, which is probability of success. Duh. You know, what's the chance we're going to find the person? And we had this driving equation, probability of success equals probability of area times probability of detection. Or paraphrased, our chance of finding them is better if we look where he is and use something that'll see him. The problem is that what we have is a whole bunch of areas and a whole bunch of different resources which give us different probabilities of detection. And the idea or the problem of search management is how do you optimize that equation? It's not rocket science. It does happen to belong to the science called operations research. But that's basically, unlike the people lined up shoulder to shoulder, what the command staff does is it really figures out how to optimize that equation. One of the most important tools in our toolbox that we use is this concept of lost person behavior and the statistical analysis of lost person behavior. This is pretty straightforward. It's a statistical study of what classes of subjects do when they tend to get lost. How do they behave? We go through past history. Once again, you have to know your history. And we gather information about a subject and what that particular person did. And our groupings tend to be, there are 3 groupings for children of different ages. There are hunters, backpackers, berry pickers, ginseng diggers, hikers. And all of those people tend to do different things when they get lost. We use this information. Remember we talked about that initial guess at probability of area? So we use this information to help us make some initial determinations. What I know in general is that people tend to go downhill. What I know in general is that kids, when they're young, don't have a concept of being lost, they hole up. I know that hunters and backpackers tend to walk on trails all the time or roads. And so that gives me ideas about where I need to start looking. Again, it doesn't tell us what any particular single person is going to do, but it tells us that as a group, in general, what they might do. Now, who remembers 2 years ago, story in the national news about a lost Boy Scout in Oregon? Anyone remember that incident? So there's a Boy Scout lost in Oregon. It took them 4 days to find him. As it turns out, the reason it took them so long to find him was that he clearly had read the book on lost person behavior and said, I'm going to make this hard. Right? And he did almost everything exactly opposite. So while the search was being driven by the statistics, he was doing other things. What this says is that you can never blindly apply a model. Right? You have to always add human thought and view about what's going on. Just the models will help you, but you can't just apply them. He was found fine, by the way. So, in the same way, you guys need to know your theory. What's the theory behind your problem space? I don't now or ever claim to have been an expert in large system administration. I have 5 computers at home. I have a lot of trouble keeping 5 computers up and running well. When I was at Marconi and we had hundreds of computers, I had a staff. So I didn't really need to know anything about it, and they were very good. So I don't know a lot about your problem space, your specific problem space. But you guys need to understand it. You need to know about the theories of security policies or distributed systems or OS design. Performance monitoring. What can performance monitoring do for you? What are the theories behind there? What are some of the theories in emergent behavior? The system all of a sudden starts doing something weird. Is that a systemic problem with the system, or are you under attack? Those are the parts of your theory. And then finally, kind of, what's your user psychology? Is there an analysis of lost user behavior? And I'm sure there are some. You need to start looking at that and figure it out. You need to know your resources. The resources that we have at our disposal define for us our methods or the tactics that we can use. We have specific ones in the lost person's search space. You guys have specific resources in your problem space. You need to understand them and know what characteristics they have. During any large event, and certainly in the lost person world, we are overwhelmed with offers of help. I get more calls than I care to think about of people who want to come help us when we're looking for somebody. You need to understand the pros and cons of using that kind of help. When your CEO or whatever comes up and says, we'll give you whatever you need to understand the pros and cons of that. Are those people certified? Do they have a clue? Are they going to hurt you? Are they going to hurt themselves? Are they going to make things worse? You need to understand what your resources can do. You need to know how to get them. How do I get this special thing that I need? Where do I call? I need to know the response time. How long is it going to take them to get to me? If I can tell you that if I have a search on Monday morning, I am really pushed to get resources because everyone goes to work on Monday morning. If I have a search Friday morning, I get lots of people because everyone is willing to take Friday off. But Monday morning is tough. You need to know about your resources, how you get them, what they cost. So now back to a little bit more of the specifics about grounds or about lost person search. Lost person search is solved by boots on the ground. Straightforward statement. Putting people out in the field is what makes it happen. And I'm talking about a lot of boots. 200, 300 pairs of boots is not uncommon for one of these searches. The one we did in West Virginia, the last day of the search, we had 300 pairs. That was a Thursday. We were ramping up for Friday for 500 pairs of boots, and on Saturday for 1,000 pairs of boots. As you might expect, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that goes along with that. If you're out in the woods, you can't have 1,000 people peeing behind the tree. It just doesn't work. The trees wash away at that point in time. So let's talk a little bit about the types of resources we have. There are these teams we call hasty teams. They're used very, very early in a search. They're well-trained, well-conditioned teams. And their basic idea is that they take some travel aid, a road or a trail or a stream bed, where we think the subject may have gone, and they boogie down it. And they're looking for things as they go. They're looking for clues. Clues are what we look for, but they're boogieing. And their basic hope is that they're going to trip over the subject. It's the basic premise. These things are very efficient because there aren't a lot of people. They're not very personnel heavy. So they're very efficient, but they're not very thorough. When you're looking at your resources, you have to make determinations about what things fit into your problem space. Do you have resources which are somehow very efficient but not very thorough? Or resources which are very thorough but incredibly time-consuming? You need to understand when you're going to apply them, when's the best time to use each of those particular ones. The next type of search we use are grid searches. These are kind of like the ones you see on TV, although they're a little different. The spacing between these people is much larger than you're used to seeing. One of the very common ways we do this is that we walk people with so that they can just see the shoes of the people to their right and to their left. If you go through and do the statistics, that gives us about a 50% probability of detection in that area. They're just as likely to see something as to miss it. I can move them closer and get higher probability of detection, but it costs me a lot more because I'm using more people. There are these guys called man trackers, and these guys are kind of fun to watch, and I've played around with this some, and literally all I've done is play with it because it's way too much work for me. These guys are highly trained, and they literally go step by step from the subject. Has anyone ever read books by Tom Brown? So there's a guy named Tom Brown in New Jersey, lives in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey. Some very interesting books by him about searching and about man tracking. But they will literally be down on their hands and knees going from one step to the next. The thing is that they need some place to start. You can't just put them in the middle of a field and say, start looking. They need a place to start. They need information about what they're looking for. They need to know what the foot looks like. A lot of that information comes from the guys doing investigation. The investigators are kind of some of the unsung heroes in lost person search because they tend not to go out in the field. These are the guys who are talking to the family, the friends, the bunkmates, any acquaintances that this person has. These are the guys who figure out that the person we're looking for is having an affair and know the name of the lady who he's having an affair with so that we can go to that house and see if we can find them. Or that the guy is a drunk or is a closet alcoholic and which bar he tends to frequent. Or that he's, and you can't make this stuff up, right? That he is into Guido for a whole bunch of money and is worried about getting out of it with his life. And so when you find his pickup truck with the windows smashed in and blood on it, Is that really a lost person search, or is he off hiding somewhere trying to convince Guido and everyone else that he got abducted? The answer to that was the latter. But they also the guys who figure out things like, what did this kid's shoe look like? In West Virginia, this boy had on a pair of L.L. Bean hiking boots that had been bought 9 months previously at a closeout sale. So we went from the credit card receipt back to L.L. Bean, back to the marketing organization at L.L. Bean, where those guys moved hell and high water to find for us a pair of boots that matched what this boy had. So think about the issues of that. Closeout sale 9 months previously. They weren't easy to find. Okay, so we want to talk a little bit about dogs. Everyone has heard of search dogs and has this image of Rin Tin Tin. How many people are old enough to remember Rin Tin Tin? Okay, about half the group. And Lassie. Right. So Rin Tin Tin and Lassie clearly could do it, right? There's just absolutely no doubt. And as it turns out, a really well-trained search dog and a really well-trained dog handler are pretty close to that level. What you might not know is that there are differences in search dogs. And I'm not talking about the difference between a Chihuahua and a Great Dane, or what you might think of as real search dogs, a German Shepherd and a Lab Retriever. I'm talking about how those dogs actually get their job done. So, first, a little bit of overview of how search dogs work. Everyone sheds off dead skin cells, and you shed them at a pretty rapid rate. And these cells, to the dog handlers, they call it scent, pretty straightforward, are what the dogs are trained to find. And so they go off and they sniff around because they have incredibly good noses, and they find human scent. We have dogs, and that's the way you train a dog to find anything. It's the way you train a dog to find accelerant for the arson dogs. It's the way you train a dog to find bomb material for the bomb dogs. They're given a treat whenever they find that thing. And so you keep reinforcing and reinforcing and reinforcing that. There are also dogs that are trained to search for things on water, to look for people which are under the water, and there are dogs which are trained to find cadavers. Now, you can ask how you train a dog to find a cadaver, right? And the trainers all have cadaver material, and we absolutely never ask them where they got it, because you just don't want to know. But let me start with air-scenting dogs. Air-scenting dogs are trained to find human scent that is floating in the air. So any person, any subject, has air blowing across them, and this carries these dead skin cells in an ever-increasing size but decreasing density cone of scent. And the air-scenting dogs are trained to find that cone of scent and follow it. And this is just so cool to watch, right? Because this dog will be walking along, and these dogs all work off-lead, and they go a long way from the handler. And they'll be walking around in a field, and the handler will be walking down, and all the handlers have these little puff bottles that have powder, and they go poof, and they shoot some powder up in the air, they look at the wind direction and try to say something that makes you believe they actually have a clue what's going on. Right? Whereas reality, we know it's the dogs who know what's going on. But you'll see this dog running around, and it'll change its affect, the way it's behaving. And then it moves into the scent cone, and it moves and it moves, and it pops out the one side. And so what's it do? It turns around, it comes back into the scent cone. And you can just watch it in this ever-decreasing set of oscillations until it runs off in the woods somewhere, and then they're all trying to come back with this thing called a refind, They come back to their handler to sit down and do something special. And the handler goes, "Find," and the dog goes off and finds them, and you chase them that time. It's really pretty amazing to watch. Tracking and trailing dogs work a little bit differently. Tracking and trailing dogs still smell human scent, but what they do is they smell the human scent which is very close to the ground or actually on the ground. Some of them are actually trained to scent crushed vegetation. So they find this human scent and they follow it. And these are the ones that you think, this is Cool Hand Luke stuff, right? Where the guys are running around behind the bloodhounds, woo, 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 and being pulled along with their things. We get trailing and tracking dog handlers hurt all the time because they don't have any view of what's going on around them. And they're getting drug along by this dog, so they run into things. When we're training, we actually do this on purpose. We have the subject that we're looking for walk really close to a tree or something and see if the dog handler will actually whap the tree because it's funny. These dogs look for specific things. They look for a specific scent. So we give them a scent article, right? You know, that whole bit about on TV where they grab the shirt and go, "Here, smell this. Lassie, go find this." And that's kind of how it works. We're a little bit more careful about that because if I actually grab a hold of the thing, guess who the dog finds? Me. So you can see these are very different tools. The air scenting dogs, we just put somewhere and say, go find a human. The trailing and tracking dogs, we have to have some place for them to start. We say, start here. Here's what this person smells like. Go find them. Very different tools. Very different uses. You need to know which one you're using. And you need to know the requirements of it. Right? It's bad news to the search manager who puts an air scenting dog in the same area with another search team. Because the dog is trained to find humans. He finds the other search team. Guess what? The dog's done his job. You have to go through this whole little thing where the handler gets out a little toy, plays with it, gives him a little treat. The dog comes over all happy and all. And then the search handler comes back and lets you know just exactly how incompetent you are to have arranged this. Now, I'm sure that none of you guys work with people like that who would have some view about your incompetence and let you know it.
Never met a professor?
Yes. Okay, the next one is aircraft. Aircraft are way cool, right? We really like to use aircraft on searches because sometimes we get to go for a ride. Not that the aircraft is ever, you know, kind of really a really good tool for us, but man, it is neat to go for a ride. So they're fun. And I'm sure you know some people like that too, who just use the stuff because it's fun, not necessarily the right thing. In general, we have two types of aircraft. We have these fixed wings, planes, and rotary wings, helicopters. The fixed wings are great because they can cover a lot of area, but guess what? They're not very thorough in doing it. Their probability of detection is low because they move quickly. The rotary wings can move more slowly, but they cover much less area. What's much more interesting are the tools that we can actually put on these things. There's this thing called FLIR, forward-looking infrared, which is great for spotting deer herds. It's not so great, it seems, for finding subjects, but it's really good for knowing where the deer are. And this thing basically flies along looking for differences in temperature. This means a couple of things. Your subject has to be at a different temperature than ambient. Right? So if it's really hot outside, the stuff doesn't work. Or if your subject's been missing for a really long time, the stuff doesn't work. The other thing which is pretty cool we're just starting to use is this spectral analysis stuff. The basic premise of this is that you tell it, Johnny had on an orange jacket, find orange. And you fly this thing around and it says, whoa, orange. It's actually not quite that straightforward. And you can guess what this might have been used for in the past, right? This was used for finding marijuana fields. So the current owners of this, the military, tend not to like to tell us much about how it really works. But it's an interesting thing. One of the problems with these resources is you have to be able to land them and fuel them. Right? Know what the requirements of your resources are. One of the other really important things we use as a resource is a set of forms. And we run searches by paperwork. And these forms, in some sense, tell us everything we have to do. They don't tell us how we should do it or the order, but they tell us everything we have to do. You need to figure out what those things are for you. This thing on the left is a checklist. At 3 o'clock in the morning, after having been up reasonably late the night before, I can tell you that I don't think awfully clearly. I don't want to have to think about all of these reflex things that need to happen. I don't want to have to think that one of the most important things in the command base is a place to plug in the coffee pot, or that I need to assign an incident commander or assign positions. I need a checklist to do that. You guys need to figure out what your checklist is and put together a kit that you can just grab. We had business continuity kits at Marconi that were basically all the forms and everything we needed to run an incident if something happened with one of the facilities. And they also included stuff like all of the office supplies, because you don't want to be looking for a stapler at 3 o'clock in the morning either. You need to know your resources. What can you get? What tools do you have to help you do what you're trying to do? Do you have access to computer security experts? Do you know where they are? Do you know how to get them? Do you know how long it takes them to show up? The same thing for your operating system guys, networking guys, equipment manufacturers. If you guys have a failure at 3 o'clock in the morning with some piece of equipment, do you know where to get another one? Do you know how to get a hold of your equipment sales guy at 3 o'clock in the morning? Do you know how to get a hold of your local phone company or your local service provider who's bringing your T1 in at that time in the morning? Do you know how to get a hold of CERT? Do you know how to get a hold of the FBI? And what kind of care and feeding do they need? If you run, I'll tell you that if you run a low level or a low low energy operation where you're all dressed like this and you ask the FBI to come in, guess how they come in? Suits. Right? And so if you're trying to keep quiet what's going on and all these guys in suits show up, when we called the FBI and the Marconi, we said, look, this is a casual organization. Could you guys dress down? And so what that meant to them was that they came in sport coats. Okay, so you've done all the pre-planning. You've got everything in place. You know how to get your resource and all. And now the game's on. It's time to do something. With any large incident, with anything going on in your organization, it's important that you know and that people know the chain of command. Who's doing what, who's responsible, who's in charge. In emergency incidents, that chain of command is defined by something called the incident command system. This system is used by law for every emergency incident in the United States. All operations under ICS use a standard terminology. They all have a standard defined organizational structure. They have a standard defined number of people who can report at each level, span of control, so that when things are going on at 3 in the morning, you can get all this in place and working, and that when I have 4 or 5 organizations come together, everyone understands the basic structure and terminology. As I said, it's used to create an incident management structure. This guy named the incident commander is at the top. The Air Force and the Air Force has a really great name for that guy. It's called the DOB, the designated officer to blame. And there's these common terminology for the positions. There are these staff positions. There's the safety officer. The safety officer's responsibility to make sure that things are being done in a safe manner. For us, that's a big deal. Right? It looks really bad if I put people in the field and they get hurt. For you guys, you need to figure out whether you need a safety officer. Are you doing big things in your power plants? Do you need somebody to worry about that kind of stuff? When you've been running for 19 hours and people haven't had any sleep, is it okay to let them drive home? Those are the kinds of things that the safety officers worry about. In our operation, the safety officer talks to everyone who's a driver. And if that person hasn't had enough sleep, we deem it a risk. We use the dark room method. The driver goes into a dark room for 15 minutes. They can leave whenever they come out. If they come out in 15 minutes, they can leave. If they come out in 2 hours, they can leave. You need to think about that. What kinds of things do you need to do? There's a position called the public information officer. Who's going to get information out? Who's going to get information in your incidents out to the CEOs, out to the other people? In our instance, who's going to get the information out to CNN, out to the Today Show, out to the local broadcasting organizations? Then there are general liaisons. Are there groups that I need to assign somebody to take care of? If I have a big customer that's down because of my problem, I might assign a liaison for them, a single person that they can always go to and get to know what they want. In the search world, we assign family liaisons, somebody who's responsible for telling the family everything about what's going on. Then there are these sections, and the sections are each headed by a guy called the chief, and we're going to be talking about those a lot more. The interesting ones are plans and ops, logistics and get stuff, and finance pays for things. So plans. Plans is the organization that provides the strategy for what's going on. As an incident commander or somebody running something, I set daily objectives. I say, I want to cover the high probability areas with a 50% POD. That's the level of control that I give. Plans figures out how they're going to do that, what actual segments there are, what kinds of tasks they need to put out to make that happen. That's plan's job, implementing the strategy. A significant part of that strategy, remember I talked about the initial POA, the probability of area, is figuring out that. So plan's uses the lost person search analysis, some other information about what's gone in the past, some history, and they come up with a consensus method for doing that. Basically, each person in a plan's organization, or a small set of them, look at all the segments, say, oh, I think this one is 50% probability and this one's 60%. Well, you can't do that, right? 50% and 20%. So they all add up to 100. And they all do that separately, and you get together and put them together for a consensus method. As it turns out, in the 1960s, the guys in search management thought they invented this. In the 1960s, this exact same technique was used to look for a lost Russian submarine in the Atlantic. It was called the Monte Carlo method. They got together a set of experts and said, you have $100. How much are you going to bet on each of these locations? And then they counted up the pile of money on each location, and the one with the most pile had the highest probability. So they looked there first. Ta-da. Okay. So plans takes the incident objectives and creates a strategy. The interesting thing about plans is they're often looking 12 hours out. So they're writing things to happen 12 hours from now. They write this thing called the task assignment form. And the TAF is a piece of paper which describes in some detail the task that they're to execute. And they also crunch the numbers. And this stuff often happens very late at night and you wonder how they ever do it reasonably well. If I search an area, I can actually search it multiple times using different techniques and different tools. Each of those searches has a probability of detection. I can ram them together through some mathematics and generate a cumulative probability of detection. Now, if I search an area and that area had a probability of area, and I search it and I don't find anything, what do you think has to happen to the probability of area for that particular piece of real estate? It has to come down, right? I've looked through it. It doesn't have to go to zero, but it has to come down. And so then you have this thing called shifting POAs, where because that one came down, that meant the probability of area of all the other ones had to go up, because in the end, the probability has to equal one. So they run all of these numbers, and that happens overnight. I talked a bit about the TAF. This is the communication method between plans and ops. Plan says, this is the strategy that I want you to implement. I actually want you to make happen. We'll talk about management resources later, but the guys who work in plans tend to be very different than the guys who work in ops. And so as the incidents get larger, those things need to separate. The guys in plans like to sit and think, and the guys in ops hate sitting and thinking. They like it in the middle of the fire. Right? So understand your resources, know what they're good at. A little bit about briefings. Everyone in an operation wants to know what's going on. Everyone that you work with when something incident has happened is going to want to know what's going on. So you have to keep them up to date. We have a daily briefing with everyone, telling them what's going on, what are the general objectives for the day. And then we have briefings at appropriate levels for the people in the management team, and then the lower down for the people who are actually going out in the field. The guys in the field don't need to know everything. In fact, there are times that because when we want to validate something, we'll put another team in the field without telling them that this first team found something, and ask them to look, right? Because we're trying to validate some other clue. Press briefings are incredibly important. This is the responsibility of the public information officer. The press has a job to do. They are going to put something on TV or in the newspaper, and you have complete control over what they put out there. If you ignore them, they'll put out stuff they make up. If you feed them the right stuff, they'll put out stuff you want. And so that's something you need to think about. The PIO is your image to the outside world. Choose them carefully. Okay. So plans writes all these TAFs, which are implementing the strategy. Ops is about tactics. Ops is about how to actually get that whole thing to happen. They convert those TAFs to boots on the ground, dog noses in the air, and airplanes flying. Said the TAF describes everything that needs to get accomplished in the search. It defines what has to happen. There is a TAF for everything. If we send out a hasty team or a grid team or a dog team, there's a TAF. If I send out somebody to buy more batteries, there's a TAF written for that. Because that TAF not only has the instructions, it has the people's names. And so when somebody calls in the base and they say, "Is my husband there?" we have to be able to find them. And we can do that by going through all of the tasks that are in progress and all the people that are back in staging. More importantly, it's how we know we didn't lose anybody. So when the team comes back out of the field, one member less, right? It's really nice to know what that guy's name was, know how much of a pain in the butt he was to figure out whether or not the team was justified in leaving him. The Ops takes the TAF. They find a field team leader, a guy to execute that task. They brief him on it. He goes off and finds people to do it. He puts together a little team, and they go off and execute. They come back, and Ops debriefs them. What went well? What didn't go well? What did you find? That information gets bubbled up along the TAF back into plans. Oh, yeah, and finally about those clues. In lost person search, there are a ton of clues. In Western Pennsylvania is one of these big, or Pennsylvania is one of these big hunting states, right? West Pennsylvania is a very big hunting area. If I'm looking for a hunter who's lost and was out grouse hunting with a shotgun, you have no idea how many shotgun shells committed people can find when they're walking along through the woods. Not all of those matter to me. In fact, the vast majority of them don't matter to me. The clues come into communications. Communications looks at it, logs it, plots it on a map. Some method of plotting the clues in your incident. For us, it's a two-dimensional map. You need to figure out whether it's module or machine or location in your network. If those clues are significant, they're brought to plan to ops attention immediately. If it's significant, then it goes to plans and the IC. In the end, the IC signs off on every valid clue that there is. This last search that we did, I think I counted the clue log. There were 76 clues, every one of which I looked at and signed off on. The last one was the best. It was the clue from the radio operator was found subject, and my response about how they should handle that was bring them in. Right? It was easy. The occurrence of clues and significant clues once again changes POA for those areas. If I find a clue in an area, that has to change the probability of area for that area. Management resources. Alluded to earlier, you've got to know who's good in good plans and ops. There are different kinds of people. Know who's good at... I did some consulting at one point for General Dynamics in Fort Worth. And this is when they were still building F-16s out there. And I worked in an area that was secure, and I did not have a security clearance. So I had a person who went with me everywhere I went, and in the F-16 area it wasn't too bad, but every now and then I did some work in a thing that they were calling ATF, the Advanced Tactical Fighter, before the fly-offs had happened for the F-18. When I walked into that room, the person who went with me carried a little box that had a flasher on the top and it beeped. And absolutely everyone in the room sat back from their terminals, crossed their hands. If they had things on their screen, they taped pieces of paper over them. If you're going to work in that kind of environment, you need to have the right temperament for it, knowing that the entire room is waiting for you to do something. If what you do is you like thinking long-term and big views, that's not the place for you. That's an ops place. The long-term view is plans. Logistics, we didn't talk about much. We like to use locals for logistics because they're good at getting things. We, all, once again, often don't ask. In our world, that means they're good at knowing who manages the local Walmart, so that when we need cases of water, they can come to us. You need to figure out what that means in your world. Who's good at getting the phone company to do things for you? So, how are you going to use ICS in your event? ICS is not about wildfires or lost person search. It's about a structure for managing emergency incidents. It's standard terminology. Everyone understands what everyone else is talking about. There is, you know, the whole idea of response teams. It's a team of people that can do stuff for you. The officers, you need to figure out whether or not you need a safety officer. You need to figure out whether or not you need a PIO. When your world goes down, right, who's going to tell the CEO what's going on? Who's going to tell all the other people about what's going on internally? Who's going to tell the customers? If that's a sales guy, who's going to brief the sales guys? And then you need to think about sections. What are you going to do in plans? Are those the ones who are going to try to figure out long-term what's going on while ops is trying to get something up running again? Ops is probably going to be swapping out servers. In our world, when we had the hack, we swapped out complete servers because we wanted to save the forensics. Luckily enough, we had development systems in place that we could do that with. If you didn't have those in place, how are you going to do it? What are you going to use to maintain that evidence? The after action. When it's all done, you got to figure out what went well, what didn't go well. What should you change in your pre-plans? What do you need to put in your history databases to make the next time something like this happen work much better? This can get to be, you know, a real finger-pointing bitch session, and you have to keep that from happening. You can get a whole bunch of information from it if they're run well. The best way to handle an incident is not to have it happen at all. Preventative efforts need to be part of your daily routine. We run a program called Hug a Tree. Hug a Tree was developed in 1981. A 9-year-old boy got lost and died. This guy named Ab Taylor, who at the time was probably one of the best man trackers in the U.S., was really, the entire team was upset by this event. And one of the reasons that they had problems was that Jimmy Beveridge kept moving around. Right, so Hug a Tree is all about teaching kids what to do if they get lost. And we give these programs, and the line is, hug a tree, hug a tree. A tree can be your friend. Right? And it's all about keeping them in one place. You know, what are your preventative works? Right? What kind of system security tests are you doing? When was the last time you did a security test? Was it planned? Was it unplanned? Did everyone know it was coming? Or did you just kind of spring it out? What about infrastructure? Backup power. How often do your emergency generators get run? How often does the fuel in them get tested? What are you going to do in that case? What about physical security? How often have you done a test where you get somebody to walk into your facility and walk through? What about HR policies? When you whack somebody in your organization, how long does it take that information to get from HR to the system admins who are turning off things? Those are the kinds of preventive things you need to put in place and be thinking about. And there are hundreds of these. But every incident you can prevent is one that you don't need to do all of this other work on, and is one less time your phone is going to go off at 4:00 in the morning. So that about covers it. I've talked about how we manage and how you might think about managing losses on large incidents. I've talked mostly about lost person search, but what I hope you take out of this is that there's an underlying structure that can actually help you handle these things. I hope that you're thinking about what you need to do when you get back to the office, what kind of pre-planning you need to put in place. What kinds of resources do you need to have? What kinds of history do you need to go dig up about what's happened previously? What kind of team are you going to put together to help you? Are you going to try to put something in place so that when your phone goes off at 3:00 in the morning, everything's there to start happening immediately? Where are you going to get coffee? What I tell people is not only this is why I stay in base, I also tell people is that base is where the coffee pot is. Right? And while they're out there walking around in the woods getting wet and cold, I'm in base drinking coffee. Oh, and by the way, it was Colonel Mustard in the library with a candlestick. Okay, the end. I'll be glad to answer any questions you folks have, either about how you might use this in your world or about lost person search.
Hi. I'm trying to put this in context with what we do as you were talking, and of course the event that keeps coming to mind, I don't know if you're aware of it, but probably most of the people are here. In Dallas, Rackspace had a really big downtime this weekend, which is a pretty popular provider, and I know only a little bit about this incident from what I've read in the news, but they managed to put a whole bunch of people on the ground actually dealing with this. They said over 100. And I was thinking, you know, most of our organizations, even the larger organizations, probably can't muster 100 people overnight, 100 trained IT professionals to solve a problem. So this incident command system has a lot of people, even in the sort of command section, the top part of the diagram. So I wonder, how do you scale that down to fewer people and still have these separate jobs?
Right. So the what we think about is we always think about positions and not necessarily people. So when I roll up on a search, when we could call it early into a search and I roll up, we'll have two people in the command structure. Well, one person who's the incident commander and one person doing ops, or this thing we actually call PLOPs, plans and ops mixed together, you know, getting teams out in the field. So, and then we grow it as we need it. But I've gone through and I've got all the paperwork that I need in place so that as it grows organically, I don't have to go back and recreate things. Part of that issue is knowing that whole pre-planning bit about knowing how you're going to get resources quickly. And if you can solve this thing if you can solve this in an hour, this stuff doesn't make much sense. It just, you know, it's overhead. Like I said, what we always try to do is we try to start putting the structure in place so that when I find out that the thing I thought I could solve in an hour is now going to take 12, that I've got the world kind of ready to deal with that. Rudy.
Yeah, a quick question, not completely related to the thing you're going to talk about, but I was wondering how much of IT and computers do you use in search and rescue in the operations you're laying out?
Boy, we would love to have somebody do this for us, because you can see that we use them in globs, right? So there are guys who are in ops making maps and printing maps and things, and there are guys in plans who are plotting clues, or in communications plotting clues, so they're doing some geography stuff. There are people who are running little spreadsheets that do things like these shifting probability of areas and probability detection calculations. What we don't have that we would truly love to is an integrated system. Because you can see that what I ought to have is I'd have a laptop at sign-in where people come in and they sign in all their registration. What you'd really like to do is swipe a card, sign in all their stuff, and so that when I need a field team leader, when ops needs a field team leader, can type in, give me a field team leader, and he'll get one out of the database. There are some places working on that, but they're not there yet. And so we do a lot of it by hand. I have a lot of what I call human copiers. Every task assignment form has some basic stuff on it. The date it was created, the communications channels are going to be used, the name of the incident. And I have human copiers sitting there doing that. And what I'd really like is to be able to just print those things off.
Yeah, and for the really tricky thing, do you have contingency plans for the computer-related stuff that you're using?
Luckily enough, you know, my answer is yes, absolutely. Because we use so little of it, when it breaks, we just keep going back to paper. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a big issue for us. And it's really only now, search and rescue in the Eastern U.S., is done almost entirely by volunteer organizations. And it's only gotten to the point now where equipment has gotten cheap enough that we can think about doing this. Right? You know, before, the idea of having 6 laptops and a router, a little wireless net, was, you know, These guys are worried about where they're going to buy extra boots. That was cost prohibitive. But that's starting to, in terms of the equipment cost, that's changed significantly. And we're starting to use more and more computers in the search incident. Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how to get my boss to buy me a dog. but I was wondering if you had any comments on the Steve Fawcett search.
I actually haven't. Once it dropped out of the news, I haven't paid much attention to it. What I find very interesting there is that the ELT, every airplane is required to have this thing, and it's called an ELT, Emergency Location Transmitter, that goes off. Normally, they go off on the runway because the pilot forgot to turn it off when he took it out of the back of the plane. And a message goes up to a satellite and goes down to this thing called the AFRCC, the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center, and they call the local Air Patrol guys, and they go out on the runway and find it and yell at the guy. But Fawcett's ELT didn't go off, and I don't understand why that is. I know that they put a lot of people in the field, but like I said, it didn't pay a lot of attention to the details of it, so I can't really comment.
Do you need volunteers to help you design and implement this computerized response system?
Absolutely.
And if so, who do we talk to?
Come up and see me later. I'll give you a card.
Hi. I'm wondering if you could comment on morale and energy issues as things drag on.
Can I? So in the search we just did in West Virginia, it went 4 days, and we were by the fourth day. The first 2 days had been pretty cold at night. We were pretty convinced that what we had switched to, although we hadn't told the entire operation yet, was a recovery. And we actually had, on day three of that search, we brought in the Red Cross has psychological support people, and we brought them in to help. And they were still incredibly low-key at that point in stage. The Red Cross psychological people usually wear these brown vests, and these guys were still incognito, just walking around finding people who looked like they were having trouble and sitting with them for a while. The briefings we talked about are an incredibly important part of that whole thing. So briefing the team about the current state, and you as the commander or the driving person continuing to put a positive view on things is in the kind of early stages how you do that. It gets to be much harder as you go further and further, and people really start figuring out that something's wrong. It's very much about communication. Now, there are a whole bunch of other things, like sleep helps. So we tend to run two complete systems, one that runs during the daylight hours, one that runs during the nighttime hours, and so that you can actually get people some sleep, food, and there are a whole bunch of other issues. But it's really that communications thing is the biggest part.
My question is about when and how to brief your public. If you've got people who are out doing the work, how do you justify pulling someone to do the communication when every minute counts?
What we've learned is that over time is that if you don't control the whole communications, the whole media bit, whether it be internally or externally, if you don't control that, sooner or later it's going to come control you. Because sooner or later, something's going to get out that you don't like, and your boss or your chief executive officer or the governor is going to land his helicopter. And if you think taking one person to handle things for a little while for communications is tough, wait until the governor lands. It sucks up all kinds of resources. So the way you justify it is by saying, if I don't do it, it's going to take me, the end result is going to cost me a bunch more. In my world, we actually often use the public to get out information, the press, to get out information. So we also justify it that way. It's a way for us to get out things about the search that's going on. And we justify it by saying, this is all good for us for the next one. If we look bad during this one, we're not going to get a chance to fix the next one. So we're always looking ahead towards that. And it's tough. Taking somebody to do that is hard. And they need to be reasonably well-rested and clear-eyed because they get asked questions they're not ready for, and that gets bad. Back one.
In search and rescue, you know, a lot of the time it's you know, a group of people looking for one person, so you don't have a whole lot of impact on the group of people. You have the ongoing sleep and attrition and everything. But compare that to natural disasters and other emergency incidents where even if you set up, you know, a good ICS, half of the people there may not be able to participate in it because they're impacted by the disaster. How do you account for that?
In kind of the natural disaster areas and looking at how to do things in those, we run into these now and then, not in the Katrina sense, but we have reasonably floods in parts of Pennsylvania. What you tend to bring in with you is you bring in an entire team that helps run the operation so that, because we know that the people aren't going to be there to help. In any of those things, almost in any incident, and you'll find this in yours, all of the immediate stuff happens at a very local level. And if that's enough, that fixes it. If, as it gets larger, and you need to have more people, when the whole infrastructure is gone, you need to bring that with you. And so that's where you start seeing things like the federal task forces come in, or in the state individual task forces. I'm on the state team, and we travel with everything we need to run 100 people self-contained.
Hi there. In search and rescue, sharing best practice is obvious and desirable. In IT response, then best practice in some sense could be a competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem, and how can we work around it?
Is that a problem? I mean, the answer is clearly yes, it's a problem. I think that what it takes then is figuring out how to sanitize at some level what you did so it becomes generic enough that it doesn't provide the information. The other thing is, and you know, I played at the VP level of these organizations, and I would never have said this when I was doing that, but places like this where you can talk to your peers and talk about, well, you know, this thing happened to me, and this is kind of how we handled it. That's how you move that best practice around. You kind of keep it below the radar. Did I say that? That was Don, not the VP of Marconi, talking. Okay, thank you.